Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi. Welcome to your neighborhood pharmacy.
Hi, I've got a prescription for diabetes test strips. How much is the copay?
Well, it depends on your type of commercial insurance and factoring in your yearly spend, subtracting the deductibles, also depending on your monthly allowance.
Why can't there be a better option?
Or you could try Contour Next test strips. A 35 count's only $19.99 over-the-counter and proven to be highly accurate. Go to contournext.com/radio to see if over-the-counter strips are a more affordable option for you.
I think I'll try Contour Next.
Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of Diaries of an Old Lady. I'm Dave Downey, and throughout this series both myself and Matt Jones are going to tell you the story of Goodison Park as you've never heard it before. Everton will be moving to a new home in the not too distant future, so we've decided to begin documenting Goodison's greatest moments in a way that's never been done before, with a series of uniquely produced podcasts released every single week with the in-depth interviews of the moments that shook the old lady to her very core, told by the people who made it happen and those in attendance. The story begins in what we think is a fitting way. My first guest on Diaries of an Old Lady is a man who played a massive part in bringing about Everton's most successful era. This man won two league titles, a Cup Winners' Cup and an FA Cup. He's also the club's post-war record goal scorer. It is, of course, the legendary Graham Sharp.
Having the fans behind you, you know, at home, will get you over the line. And we knew when we needed a little bit of help, would get it. Together it was a fantastic experience to be a player at the time, and I'm sure a fan as well.
In towards Andy Gray, up go the heads, flicked on towards Sharp. Oh, it's there! Graham Sharp has put it in, and Everton are level. Andy Gray's header onto the near post, forced in by Graham Sharp, who has scored in every round of the competition and keeps up the record at the time that Everton needed it most. One more and it's Rotterdam. Stevens takes a throw in towards the near post. Trap Hill, no, he didn't. Gray locked it in. It's a goal. Andy Gray has put Everton in front. Fired and furious because Faf came for the long throw. Felt he was impeded, didn't collect it. But Andy Gray didn't stand around and find out. He thumped it in the back of the net. Celebration time at Goodison Park. They're very close to their first European final now, because Andy Gray, a hat-trick in the quarter-final, has come up with a crucial semi-final goal. And Everton are in front and are on the way to Holland. It's Andy Gray breaking inside the Bayern half. Trevor Stephen has a great chance into the penalty area. Trevor Stephen sends Everton to the final. 3-1 the score on the night. And that will be the goal that does it. Trevor Stephen's first ever in European competition sends Everton to their first ever final. And you can tell your grandchildren about this night. Corner kick on the right-hand side. Sheedy will take it in towards the near post. Not headed away convincingly by Gregory. Back in by Gray. Vandenhout, Mountfield, 1-0. Derek Mountfield breaks the deadlock. Here's Bracewell, midway inside the Rangers' half. Square to Pat Vandenhout. Crossed in again with the left foot. Graham Sharp with a headed chance. 2-0. Graham Sharp's 30th of the season. Ignites the fuse. The party has started. Everton now are the champions. You can be sure of that. Everton have a throw-in just inside their own half on the left-hand side.
The referee, milking the situation, has his whistle in his mouth. That's it. Champions! Everton complete the first leg of the treble and go on to Rotterdam and to Wembley as the champions of England.
Howard, congratulations. How does the championship feel the second time around?
Well, it feels very sweet tonight. This is a hard slog. We start off in August and we want to prove to be the best, like everyone else. And we've achieved that today. With five games left, I think it's a tremendous achievement on behalf of the players.
When you were at Dumbarton Sharpie and you got the call that Everton were interested in you, what was it that attracted you to come down to England and experience playing for the club?
Well, I think it was always something I wanted to do. As a kid, I wanted to be a footballer. And I was fortunate enough, I had a good amateur career. And then I went to Dumbarton part-time, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But my ambition was always to play at the highest level I possibly could. And in those days, it was down in England. You know, obviously Rangers and Celtic appealed. But it was English football I wanted to try. My hero at the time was Andy Gray. My favourite team was Aston Villa because of Andy Gray. And before I signed for Everton, I had the opportunity to go to Villa. But unbeknown to me, the directors had disagreed over something. I'm not too sure. So Villa weren't happy. But when I first came down to Everton with my dad drove me down. I came down not thinking that I was going to sign. I just thought I was coming down to look around the place. Went to Belfield. Trouble finding that to start with. But looked around Belfield. Got introduced to the players, George Wood. He said Hartford, John Gidman, Bob Latchford, Brian Kidd, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, these are top players. So it was an experience for me. Then we went to Goodison. Wow, and, you know, the size of the stadium, there was a restaurant in the stadium. We had a lunch there, and I'm thinking, wow, this is good. I've never been to a football stadium before and seen that side of things. So I thought, wow, great. Then the next minute I know, the director and the manager of Dumbarton have been called into the secretary's office to talk to Jim Greenwood. They came out after about 20 minutes. They just asked my dad and I to go in. And they put a contract in front of me. It was as simple as that. There was a contract, you know, and I looked at my old fella and I thought, what do I do? Help. And the contract was 3 years, 150 quid a week. I think it was £5,000 a year signing on fee. And I looked at my dad. My dad just said, it seems like a fabulous club. It's something you've always wanted to do, so it's up to you. So I signed the contract there and then, shook hands with Jim Greenwood, the secretary, walked out, drove back up the road to Glasgow. My dad drove back up the road. I went out that night and played football with my mates in the local park and saying to them, I've just signed for Everton. They're like, yeah, good one. I said, honestly, I have. Read it in the papers in the morning. So that was how easy it was, you know, but it was something I always wanted to do.
Now, the club itself wasn't in the best state back then. I think Gordon Lee was sort of coming towards the end of his time at Everton, and he put that faith in you to come down. There's a couple of other young players who joined you at the same time. What was the perception of Everton at that time? Was it that it had petered out? Because we won the league in 1970. At that stage, obviously, before all the success that was to follow, were we considered a sleeping giant back then, or were we just and also ran in the top division?
From my point of view, Dave, it was just the fact that I wanted to come down to England and play football. And obviously I was a student of football, if you like. I knew everything about every English team and where they played and the names of the stadiums and the players they had. So I was well aware of the good players that Everton had, the ones I've mentioned before. You know, they were a good squad, you know. And, you know, these were players that I saw on television and I read about in the Shoot magazine and the Goal magazine at the time. So I knew I was joining a big club. You know, obviously, once you get down to the club and you start to learn more and more about it and the history and the players that have been before you and what you have to live up to. And that was something that was mentioned because I was coming down as a centre forward. I scored a few goals at Dumbarton right away, you know, in the first few conversations I had with supporters. It was Joe Royal, Bob Latchford, Dixie Dean, Alex Young, you know, all these people that you had to, if you were wanting to wear the number 9 at Everton, you had to try and emulate. So there was pressure on me from that side of things, but I knew I was joining a big club. You know, I knew I was joining a big club. But in those days, you know, you'd say the top clubs were unfortunate, were our neighbours, you know, and the fact, I think, that, you know, they were full of Scotsmen as well. You know, Dalglish and Hansen were there, and Souness later on. You know, it was a big thing for me to come down to Liverpool as a city, but, you know, I knew I was joining a big club and I joined Everton.
We see it nowadays when players refer to clubs as stepping stones and using them as a destination to get perhaps to somewhere else, somewhere bigger and better. Maybe Everton are one of those clubs now. Was that the case back then, or was it very much of a muchness in terms of English clubs? There was more scope for any club to really do well, providing they had the right players. The finances obviously weren't the same as they are now.
I think it's changed, Dave. And I think in those days, you just wanted to play. You know, we wanted to play football. When I first came down, I wanted to get in the first team. That was the main goal. That was the main objective. I wanted to play at Goodison in front of 50,000, whatever it was, 52,000. That was my goal. You know, I just wanted to come down here and play football. You know, in the early years, it was a possibility I could have moved back to Scotland. Alec Ferguson wanted me at Aberdeen. There was talk about another couple of clubs down here as well, but that was of no interest to me. You know, I had a 3-year contract when I first came down. I wanted to prove myself here. It was difficult. It was a bit of homesickness, but I never ever viewed Everton as a stepping stone. You know, I always knew, right, this is my chance. This is what I wanted to do. I want to play in the first team. I want to play alongside these players. And then when you get into the side, you want to play to win things then. You know, you want to play because it's your own personal pride. But as a player, you want to win things. You know, whether it's a five-a-side on a Friday morning or whatever, you wanted to win. So that was my genuine belief. I didn't see myself, if I did okay here, I'd maybe go back to Rangers or Celtic. I never even thinking that. Listen, later on in my career, I had the opportunity to join a few clubs kind of thing, but no, I'd always stayed loyal to Everton because Everton was a club that gave me the opportunity. It was a club that I was really, really happy with, and there was no really reason for me to move on.
And it was Gordon Lee more so, but he came to the end of his time pretty quickly after you arrived. Were you then thinking, what's next? What's the new manager going to be like? What's going to happen here? And of course, it was Howard Kendall, already a legend at the club as well. Was it an uncertain time for you when he came in?
Absolutely. You know, listen, when I came down at first and when I came, I was nowhere near the first team. Nowhere near. I was only a skinny lad from Scotland, which, you know, might be hard to believe nowadays. But it was tough for me, and I was miles away. I remember making my debut, you know, at Brighton, coming on for Bob Latcher, and I'm thinking, I'm like a school kid in the playground here. I'm miles away from this, you know, experience-wise, strength-wise. So I thought, wow. Then, listen, Colin Harvey was a great help to me, and pushed me really hard in the reserves, and he made me become the player I was. But, you know, once a manager leaves that signed you, you then think, wow, how's this going to go? Then he comes in, Howard Kendall, and signs the Magnificent Seven. You know, of those seven, you know, you've got Mick Ferguson, Alan Bailey. You've already got Peter Easto there, who was a good player. And you're thinking, this isn't good. You know, I'm getting knocked down. And he made it quite abundantly clear at the beginning this is the way he was going to go. Obviously, history tells you that it didn't work out for those players apart from Neville, but eventually I think because he had no other option, he had to play me. You know, that's how I got my opportunity. Notts County away, Bailey was injured, Ferguson was injured, some of the other lads who were probably ahead of me were injured as well, and he had no other option to throw me in at Notts County. I think Colin Harvey had kept championing me and saying, listen, give him a chance. Went in at Notts County, we drew the game 2-2, I scored that night, and I stayed in for the rest of the season. And it's just remarkably lucky. People talk about, you know, being a footballer and how good and everything else. You have to have luck on your side as well. You know, you could be the most talented player in the world and not have the luck. You have bad luck with injuries, but you need luck along the way. And certainly that game at Notts County, I only played because everybody else was injured. And as I said, I went on from there and, you know, I stayed in the team. So it was difficult for me at the time because you always get the feeling from the manager as well that he doesn't really fancy me here. You know, immaterial what you do, and you know, I'm not really fancying me. And then the more I was playing and the more goals I was scored, I think I kind of turned it around a little bit. But I was never ever, how could I say, you never ever sat back in your laurels because you never always knew that, you know, you could be out the door, you know, if it was up to him.
What was your relationship like with him at the start? Because to me, that sounds like he's not really come up to you and said, you need to do this and this to get in the team, or he's not said to you, well, I don't really fancy you as a player, you need to go. Was he very standoffish? Did he not have that line of communication with you where he would tell you where you were at being at the club?
No, he didn't, Dave, you're right. It's a good question, but he never had even in the successful times, I never had a close relationship with him. you know, obviously...
Did anybody else, really?
I think when the older players came in, I think you had a more of a rapport with older players. But I think for the younger players, you know, I look at that side that when I was breaking through, there was like Paul Lodge and there was Steve McMahon, Joe McBride was another one in there, and there was certain young players in there. So whilst we'd get called over maybe on a Friday to make the numbers up kind of thing, but I don't think there was any, this is what you have to do. We're always reading the newspapers to see, well, we're interested in this one, so that's putting me further down the line, blah, blah, blah. So didn't really have any interaction with the manager. You know, I was more answerable to Colin Harvey, who was a reserve team coach, and it's changed an awful lot nowadays, but certainly in those days, no, unless you were involved in the first team, the manager didn't really have a lot to do with you. Obviously, it was down to Colin and all the other coaches to put your name forward and say, listen, he'll train with you today, he's doing well in training, blah, blah, he's doing well in the games, he deserves a chance to at least train with you. And I remember doing that kind of thing, but at times it was hard, because especially when you're getting new players coming in, you're thinking, this ain't happening for me. I think Barnsley was another club I could have went to with Norman Hunter. As I said, Alec Ferguson came in for me a couple of times at Aberdeen. And it was touch and go. And in those days, when I first came down, I signed a 3-year contract. And going into that third year, you were all over the place. You know, you're just thinking, how's it going to go? And they waited and waited and waited until the last week of the season. And then you got a knock and you said, come in, okay. And it wasn't a discussion. It was a case of, there you are. We'll give you a 5-year increase. Take it or leave it. And put it in front of you. And that was how it went in those days. No agents. So, because you wanted to stay, he signed a contract, never argued about money, never even mentioned any money, blah, blah, blah. You just wanted to sit. And so I signed my second contract. And then it all went from there. You know, and obviously the better you were doing, the more money you were earning, your contracts got better and the more you felt part of the club and part of the team and somebody you wanted to stay.
Doesn't seem like it was quite the integration the players get now, you know, where you find out they've got all sorts of this support network. Mm. For you, a young lad coming down from Scotland, you don't know your arse from your elbow when you come into Goodison.
Get on with it. You know, and I was in digs for the first 2-3 years. And I have to say that the family I went with eventually were fabulous for me. You know, the second family. And really, Evertonians really looked after me. And they had a big say in what I was doing as well. You know, they made sure that, you know, you had to live your life the right way as well, you know, and they were part and parcel of it. So I was very grateful for Jimmy and Betty Duval, who had stayed in digs with. But listen, I was playing. My dad used to come down on a Saturday, Central League game, drive down from Scotland, kick off at 2:00. You know, in those days it was Everton versus Manchester United away. The reserves played at Goodison, 2:00 kickoff. I would play the game, rush out after, get changed, rush out after, jump my dad's car, drive up back up the road to Glasgow, which in those days was 4.5 hours, whatever it was, no motorways then, up, stay the Saturday night, come back down on the train on Sunday, 6:00 train from Glasgow, to come back down again to Liverpool to start training again on the Monday. So homesickness was a big thing for me as well. And, you know, when things aren't going well for you, you know, the first thing you want to do is run away and go back to where you feel you belong. But, you know, I think I got one day where my parents just sat down and said, listen, this is down to you. You know, if you really want this, you know, you need to stop, you know, coming back. And to be fair, they were right. And, you know, things got better for me in terms of the football. And hey-ho, I'd moved on.
Did you never come close to packing it in?
No, never packed it in, never.
They would have I mean, just the Everton.
Yeah, they would have had to have told me. You know, they would have had to have told me. It wouldn't have been for a lack of effort. I always remember Colin Harvey as well, and when we used to, I tell the story where we used to train in the morning, and then he'd single out, he'd go, you, you're in this afternoon, and we go, oh. And then the other lads would be laughing, and they'd be away at the snooker club and having a few beers, and like, you're out again at 1:00, and you go, oh. And I remember him pulling me one day, and he said, here, I need a word, and I said, what? He said, let me tell you, if I didn't think you had a chance of making it, you would have went with them and played snooker. He said, but I think you've got a chance. And whilst I think you've got a chance, you'll be in most afternoons working at it. And listen, he was absolutely fantastic for me. So I used to bring back Paul Lodge, Brian Burrows, Steve McMahon, Joe McBride, all those players, and we just always do different things. And obviously in my position, it was all about hold up play, getting a hold of the ball under pressure. And he worked his in the afternoon, and it was brilliant. So at no stages did I want to quit. I never ever thought of that. But I thought at times, you know, it would be touch and go whether they got another contract or not. So obviously these are the things that you want to get at the end of the your contract. But certainly I was never one that would have looked at quitting.
That patience, perseverance, words associated with things like that, probably sort of define you as a player as well. Do you feel that that sort of early learning guide that you had at the club and finding it so difficult put you in good stead for what was to come later on?
Yeah, I think so, Dave. I think growing up, people would tell me I was the worst loser in the world. I hated losing. You know, if I played something, and I know people say this, but I did, if I played something I wanted to win, it didn't matter, you know.
You're the same with the quizzes on Radio City.
No, I'm as well, yeah, but even with the kids growing up, and, you know, they'd tell you the same, whether it be Monopoly or whatever, kind of arguments, and they'd be crying and everything else. But no, that's what I was, and I think that's something that developed in me when I was playing football from a young age up in Scotland, and I just wanted to be down here and be the best and play and win things. You know, listen, you could have played for the majority of your career and not won anything, but I was fortunate that, you know, things kicked off at Everton in the right way, and, you know, we went on to be successful. That's something I always strive for. So listen, it wasn't just me, it was a group of players at the time who were all buying into the same thing, you know, and they were all winners in there as well. So listen, it takes a lot to be a success, and you certainly need the help of your teammates to do that as well.
On to Goodison then, which is sort of the basis of our conversation. You experienced it, I think, at a peculiar time, because things weren't great when you were in and around the club. What were your first impressions of it? Did you feel as if it was somewhere that had a massive potential to be a sort of a fortress if Everton got it right? Or was it a difficult crowd to appease at that time in the early going when you got your chance?
It was, Dave. I've always said that. It's a real... Goodison's fabulous, you know, when things are going well, even in our time, fabulous. But when it's not, it's the hardest place in the world to play. I remember playing there in a cup game against Coventry. I think it was 9,000 there. And wow, you could hear everything getting shouted towards you. And it's not just that, you could actually see who was shouting it. You know, there's that many gaps in the terrace. And so you could actually, so it's a really hard place. And listen, things weren't going well under Howard Kendall. And it was really, really tough. You know, you're looking around at a not full stadium, you know, pockets. Obviously, we would win some games and lose some games, but didn't seem to be any consistency in that. But, you know, slowly but surely, you know, and through, you know, the Sir Philip Carter and his trust in the manager, it came together. But the word I use again is respect. At the time, there was a respect for the football club. There was a respect from the players to the management, to the directors, to the chairman, everything else. And it was a proper, proper football club. It was a proper football club. Everybody knew the history of it and how it would, you know, the Moorses and the money they invested and everything else. But it was a proper football club. You knew that you had to be the best at everything you'd done. You knew you had to carry yourself and act properly and everything else. So there was all this pressure as well. You know, and obviously the supporters wanted to see a successful team, you know, and even like a similar to now, it doesn't happen overnight. And there was times when Howard was close. You know, I talked about the 9,000 at Coventry. You talk about the Oxford game. So these were trying times for not just Howard and the staff, but the players as well. But playing at Goodison is great. Don't get me wrong, great. And even see it now, some players can't handle it. You know, some players have come from, I would say, smaller clubs. When they get to the, you know, what they need to expect, some fall short at Goodison. They just can't handle mentally, you know, how tough it is to play there.
From when you signed to the success that you had a few years later, you've seen it at its best and at its worst. What was it like during the days, before we get onto the games you've chosen, what was it like during the days that it was at its best? I mean, we're talking peak mid-80s when we're going through our most successful stint as a football club. I mean, do you fully appreciate what's going on around you when you're playing a match there?
You do. And the one thing that amazed me was, you know, you looked at that time and, you know, the stadium was full and it was a fantastic atmosphere and everybody was in the high because the supporters were coming to the games expecting to see the team win. Us as players knew that we were going to win the game. You know, that wasn't being big-headed or whatever, but we just had that belief in us, whether it be home or away, we'd win the game. Or if we went a goal down, we wouldn't lose the game, we'd get back into it. So we had this enormous belief, and I think supporters had that as well. So they enjoyed coming through the turnstiles, you know, wanting to see goals, wanting to see good play. And I think, you look at the team we had at that time, and you know, some fantastic players. Look at Sheeds and Trevor on both sides. You know, for a centre forward like myself and Andy Gray, unbelievable. You know, when you go all the way through to the best goalkeeper in the world at the time, Kevin Ratcliffe, one of the best centre backs. We had a great team, and I think everybody realised that, and they wanted to get behind it. And the thing that amazed me in those times, and listen, it was difficult times on Merseyside, as it was in many cities throughout the UK, but the following we used to get was incredible. Even pre-season trips, you know, the other side of the world, there'd be Evertonians who travelled there, planes, trains, automobiles, whatever you want to say, they got there. And it was incredible for a pre-season friendly. So that was the thing I think it struck me, and I thought, wow, you know, these guys are, this is proper. You know, these are proper fans. This is what it's all about. And we heard about the success in the 70s with the Holy Trinity and the players here, and then before that as well. And we were well aware of the history of the football club. We were made aware of that as well, that what we had to try and emulate. So it was tough time, but it was a good time, you know, because, you know, we all came together at the right time, and we had this belief in ourselves. But the crowds were fabulous. The crowds were absolutely fabulous. And people say nowadays you draw comparisons, and you just went there and you knew as a player you had, and I always say this to people now, you knew as a player, you knew what the Evertonians were all about. If you gave it 100% commitment and had a right good go and lost the game, they'd accept that. They wouldn't be happy, but they'd accept it because they saw their team having a right good goal. They couldn't point any fingers. And I always try and say that to people. And I look at the players nowadays, and, you know, I'm looking at the boy in the ass, even, and back of Yoko, and going through all this. And lads who maybe weren't the best talented, but they had a fantastic attitude, and you could see the supporters taking to that. So we knew that we had to roll up our sleeves, and we weren't going to win every game, but if we had a right good goal, we had a good chance of winning it, and that's what we had. We had a great bunch of lads with the right attitude throughout the club. There wasn't a bad egg, and Howard has to take a lot of credit for that as well. He was very good at the players he was bringing in, made sure they wouldn't disrupt the dressing room. So it was a great time, and the fans loved it. That was the most important thing. We were great as players, but without the backing of the fans, we wouldn't have been anywhere.
On your three greatest moments that you've given me, I think I've ranked these in the order in which you'd have them. So to start with the third, first, it's the 4-4 against Liverpool. Mm-hmm. I've put Bayern at the top.
Yeah.
And obviously the winning the league 2-0 at home to QPR second. Would you say that's probably fair?
Yeah, I would say so. I think obviously the Bayern game for atmosphere was incredible. You know, the other two for atmosphere were incredible as well, but the Bayern one stands out. But, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking the 4-4 game was a derby game. Anything can happen. But at that time, the clubs were really, really close in terms of fighting for honours and everything else. But I'll remember it, and, you know, looking at it and looking back, all of Liverpool's goals were really good goals. All of Everton's goals were scrappy, scruffy. And that was just part and parcel. That's what's made it such a great game. You know, you're looking at one stage and thinking John Barnes bending one in the top corner. You go, wow, then me getting on the back pass and scuffing it in the net kind of thing from a yard out. But it was a great game to be involved in. And I remember walking off. It had everything. It was passion, as I talked about before, passion, commitment, you know, from the fans, tackles getting won and lost and everything else. And blood and guts, but coming off, and I think it was with Gary Ablett as I walked off, and I went, wow, what have we been just involved in there? What a game that was.
Staunton drives an early ball down the near side. Ratcliffe caught in possession by Rush. Now, clean through, goal number 24, is it? Rush round south, oh no! Amazing goal line clearance. Beardsley drives it back in, and it's a goal for Liverpool. Hinchcliffe, terrific defensive header though. Now into the far post, header, goal! And it was a terrific header. Grobbelaar got half a hand to it. Now Beardsley just outside the area where he likes to be. Shot with the left foot. Oh, brilliant goal. That's a magnificent goal from Peter Beardsley. There isn't a better player in the game, really. Ghosting away from a couple of Everton defenders on the edge of the area. Long clearance. Oh, missed there by Liverpool. Grobbelaar's missed it. The shot has gone in. Long clearance by Neville Southall. Real mess there between Grobbelaar and Ablett. Liverpool have a corner. Near side there, right, taken short by Beardsley to Mulby. Lot of space, right hand side of the box, clips it in, Rush with a header, 3-2. And Ian Rush has done it again. The irrepressible scourge of Evertonians gets his 24th goal in his 28th derby. Now McCall, edge of the area. Through ball, looking for Cotty. Unbelievable! And Tony Cotty, whose career at Everton has been under doubt in the last few weeks. He's been out of the side. But Howard Kendall is out of the dugout. The Everton manager is shaking his fist towards his players. Barnes is really up for it now. He's got so much confidence. Round one, then another. Curls the ball in. Great goal. That is an absolutely brilliant goal. World-class finishing. Hinchcliffe. Loose control by Hinchcliffe. Back pass is a bad one. I don't believe it. Liverpool have committed suicide once more.
You know, and it was really like, wow, because it changed. It kept changing. At one moment we're out of it, and then we were back in it, and then we're out of it, back in it, and it was a fabulous night's entertainment, you know. And I think both sets of supporters, you know, were just amazed at what they just witnessed, you know. Absolutely amazing. Obviously, at the back of it, Dalglish resigns, and we win the replay, which is the most important thing. That's what it was all about, winning the game. But what a game to be involved in! Absolutely, probably the best derby game in terms of a game and a match and commitment and passion that I've probably been involved in.
Well, the thing that I thought would make it up there for you personally was because they were your last goals for us. And again, you mentioned like that scrappy one where you're just basically chasing into the goal line. One of the iconic images we're going to be using to this for everyone to have a look at is you sort of reeling away towards the Gladys Street and the crowd behind you. Some of them are on the pitch and things like that. Did it feel for you personally like you were coming towards the end of your time with the club? Because I think you only made maybe a dozen games after that.
Yeah. Listen, there comes a time when everybody has a time. Everybody has to move on. Did I feel as if it was coming to the end? I don't know. I think when you come from the highs that we'd been, you know, and then you get people moving on and you get people moving in. And I just thought at the time, we weren't the same Everton. We weren't the same Everton that we were. You know, new signings, and it can happen with new signings.
And Colin had gone, hadn't he?
Colin had gone, and Howard came back. And, you know, you're looking at it, and I'm thinking, well, it was just the way he left was a disappointing thing for me. You know, he thought he was bringing Dean Saunders into the club. And
from Derby.
Yeah, and he said that he was coming in, and, you know, that I know he knew that I'd spoken to Joe Royal, which was rubbish, because I hadn't spoken to Joe.
This is Colin.
This was Howard.
This is Howard, sorry, yeah.
So Howard, so he says, no, I'm going to move you on, you can go to Oldham. And I said, no, I'm going to Oldham. He said, well, I'm bringing Saunders in, and it'll be Saunders and Tony Cotty up front. I said, well, fine. I said, I'll bide my time. You know, I says, I think I'll be in. But you go home. I went home that night, and more I thought about it, and I thought, well, what am I doing here? I'm thinking I've got an opportunity to go and play, and that's what I wanted to do.
You're still only 30, 31.
Yeah, I didn't want to stay somewhere where I wasn't going to play, and I was going to just sit on the bench and go here, there, and everywhere. That wasn't for me. I needed to play. So a little bit disappointed the way it ended, but listen, it has to end. You know, you can't stay there forever, you know, so it has to end. And probably by that time, yeah, I was probably ready for a move. Listen, as I said to you before, I could have moved. Many times I could have moved to Manchester United, I could have moved to Italy or France, but I always stayed loyal to Everton because I didn't really want to move, you know. But when the writing's on the wall, and when he comes up, the manager, and actually tells you that this is where the way he's going to go, I think it was the best thing for me to do was to move on.
Well, we ended up with Beardsley, didn't we? When Saunders went to Liverpool.
Yeah, Peter came in. I think it was Mike Newell there at the time as well.
But it was you two who started that, and Cotty was there.
So this is the way he wanted to go, and listen, fair play, and that's what he wanted to do. But I went to Oldham, I had a great time at Oldham, you know, 15 goals in the first year, played really, really well, really enjoyable, and a few injuries after that kind of curtailed me a little bit. But no, I thought coming to the end, when you look at my goal scoring record, it wasn't as good as it was, but probably that's down to where the team was playing and who we'd let go. And, you know, it was difficult. Listen, I've had a fantastic time at Everton. Really, really good. I couldn't say one bad word about it, you know, but it was sad when you leave, but everybody has to at one stage. And, you know, it was just the way it happened. Wasn't great. But, you know, listen, nobody can take away anything that what I've done at Everton.
Was it difficult for you as well because you'd experienced those highs, which to this day still stand, unfortunately. We haven't been able to replicate that, certainly in my lifetime anyway. When you see that in 87 and then the disappointment of what the fallout of what happened with Heisel and players moving on for whatever reason. Do you sort of, is it hard to keep yourself motivated as a player? I know you're a professional and obviously each game you're going out there to fight 100% and stuff, but mentally, internally, is there any sort of doubts that there are times being and gone here? Does that figure in your thinking in terms of maybe moving on a bit?
Well, yeah, I think, listen, when we won it at first, it was brilliant. And then the next shock was Andy Gray coming round the house and saying that he sold me and he's bringing in Gary Lineker. So that's a shock right away. And you think, well, why has he done that? We just won the cup, we're on in the league, we're going to have a right good go. That was a shock. Lineker came in. But we never...
It's the most Everton thing in the world, not winning the trophy when he come in and he scored a 40.
And I struck up a good partnership with Gary, you know, for the 1 year. He scored a lot of goals, I scored a lot of goals. Things were good, we won the league the next year. Everything was great, you know, so there wasn't a problem there. We still had that belief. But I think if you look at the difference between the first title winning season and the second one, the first one was a team one, you know, where there was 13 players, 14 possibly, you know, I'm talking about Kevin Richardson and Alan Harper. I think the second championship winning side was more of a squad. Neil Poyton, Paul Power, Wayne Clark, people like that. But I think after that, if I'm honest and I'm brutally honest, I think the quality of the player wasn't going to get us back to where we were. You know, and that's no disrespect, but what we were used to, we never got. You know, and listen, whether that's signing, and listen, everybody knows signing players is a gamble. Everything else, but I just thought the quality of the player that came into the football club weren't going to get us back to the top, you know, where it was becoming harder and harder and teams are moving on. I don't think we actually progressed, if I'm honest with you. I thought after we won our second title, I think we just kind of melted. And seeing that, Colin achieved sixth place now, and would bet your arm off of that nowadays, but you know, it wasn't deemed good enough, you know, and that shows you what the standards were at the time. You know, if six isn't good enough, you needed to be up there and winning. But I just thought when the squad was getting chopped and changed, Trevor left and Gary Stevens left, she did a few injuries, I just don't think we replaced those players, you know, with the players that would get us up to the calibre of where we were before. And that was a disappointing thing. But did it make me want to leave? That is when the opportunities came. I could have maybe moved abroad, and it didn't materialise. But listen, as I said, that's by the by. These things happen, you know, and it's just you. But I was absolutely delighted to play as many games as I did for the football club and scored, you know, 160 goals. So nobody can take that away from me. But obviously there's times in your career where you wish for a little bit more, but it wasn't to be.
It's obviously a contentious issue in this city to this day. Some of the things you hear going around about it. But as a player who was there at the time, did the lack of European football have a profound effect on everybody concerned with the club?
Listen, I think it's everybody's dream to play in the European Cup as it was then. You know, a lot of fans will say that we could have won it, which we could have, but we could have been knocked out in the first round, which we could have. You know, so we'll never know that. Sad that we never got the opportunity to do it, which inevitably has led to the breakup of the side, you know. You know, Trevor and Gary go to Rangers, and Scottish football was having a little fill up there at the time with Souness up there. But I think the European ban had a massive effect on us. I think it had a massive effect in English football. Looking back, I thought it was a wrong decision. I think it was totally wrong, you know, and it's not pointing the finger at anybody. But our fans going to Europe enjoyed themselves, had a good time, you know, went to Rotterdam, police remarked on how well they were, everything else. And I think for everybody to be punished was wrong. I know hooliganism was a big at the time in England, and I'm not saying, but I just think that for everybody to be punished, I thought was wrong. But listen, hey, what was done, and it's done, and that we can't bring it back. You know, Heisel was awful for everybody involved in it. But I thought the government at the time and Maggie Thatcher at the time was a little bit heavy-handed, and I think it certainly affected Everton, you know, on and off the field. And listen, when you're playing, everybody knows, when you're playing in Champions League or European Cup as it was, everybody wants to play it. And I've talked about, you know, bringing players in of the same calibre and everything else. If you were in the European Cup year in, year out, it would have been easier to attract better place for
as
the
it is now.
As
yeah,
it is
proof's
now.
In the pudding. Yeah. We'll go back to happier times. Mm-hmm. Your second game, Everton 2 QPR 0, 6th of May 1985. Again, researching this has been like a whole new world for me because it's before my time. We won the league with 5 games to go. I mean, to now, I can't comprehend that in my head to think that. You scored your 30th goal on that day as well, which is obviously a special memento for you to do that. Again, just referring to the atmosphere, 50,000 in Goodison that day.
52, Dave. And I think there was more than that, if I'm honest. You
people
know,
on the church,
exactly,
everything.
And as people remember now or forget now, it wasn't seated, so it was all standing, so they're all jam-packed in there kind of thing. It was
don't think the official number would ever be something you could calculate, really.
But no, it was, and listen, we'd won it, but everybody knew this was a day where you could win it at Goodison and get presented with a trophy. And I remember the game well. I should have scored in the first half, but Derek Mountfield took it off my toes and lashed it in. I was fuming. So we're 1-0 up. He scores in the park end. But second half, I managed to get ahead of it at the Gladys Street. And listen, winning the league, scoring the goal at the Gladys Street to win the league, if you like. Okay, we won it 5 games, but to win the league, to cement it, incredible moment for me. You know, and it was... I remember it now, ball coming in, I think it was Pat swung it in and got on the back post and headed back across the goalkeeper, 2-0, brilliant. The noise and the atmosphere was incredible, but it was just a combination of everything we'd worked so hard for, you know, and everybody was out. And it was that same thing, as I said, Dave, we weren't going to get beat. Queen's Park never came and rolled over, but we weren't going to get beat.
Corner kick on the right-hand side, Sheedy will take it in towards the near post. Not headed away convincingly by Gregory. Back in by Gray. Van den Hauw, Mountfield, 1-0. Derek Mountfield breaks the deadlock. Here's Bracewell, midway inside the Rangers' half. Square to Pat Van den Hauw. Crossed in again with the left foot. Graham Sharp with a headed chance, 2-0. Graham Sharp's 30th of the season. Ignites the fuse. The party has started. Everton now are the champions. You can be sure of that. Everton have a throw-in just inside their own half on the left-hand side. The referee milking the situation, has his whistle in his mouth. That's it. Champions! Everton complete the first leg of the treble and go on to Rotterdam and to Wembley as the champions of England.
Howard, congratulations. How does the championship feel the second time around?
Well, it feels very sweet tonight. This is a hard slog. We start off in August and we want to prove to be the best, like everyone else. And we've achieved that today. With 5 games left, I think it's a tremendous achievement on behalf of the players.
And that was just the spirit we had. And, you know, we went out there and we wanted to win every single game and we rolled our sleeves up and had a right good go. If somebody didn't do, it wasn't just Kevin Ratcliffe who was having a go. Everybody would be having a go at you. You know, there'd be 10 captains at half time that would go off, so you'd have to do better. And Howard and Colin Howard wasn't really an angry manager. Colin would say his say and then, you know, you'd listen. But the players would do it as well. You know, the players would have a right good go at you and say, this isn't good enough. So this is what we had. So going out in there and that game was incredible. Fantastic crowd, scoring the goal, picking the trophy up. Just this, the end of the season where you sat back and thought, wow, whoa, this was fantastic. And I think if I remember right, we got ourselves dressed, a few beers in the players' lounge, out to Southport, into an Italian restaurant. We told our wives and girlfriends, don't join us until 9 o'clock. So you can imagine by the time they came, we'd had a few, and the tables were getting banged and handed over Liverpool. Was the song getting shouted in Southport. So I don't thought that the restaurant manager was too happy, but there was no stopping us enjoying that. It was a fabulous day and just a combination of a great season.
And you must think then at that period, you know, you've been this kid who's come down from Dumbarton, had a difficult time establishing yourself at the football club. You've just knocked in your 30th goal of the season to win the top prize in English football. I would just comprehend contrasting that at the time. Is it a moment where you're like, I need to pinch myself here because I did not envisage this sort of thing happening?
I didn't, Dave, but I think it's down to all the hard work that, you know, it's like a dream. Wow, if you win every game, it's a dream. Bang, going this, we're going to Europe playing this. Bang, I'm playing by my dream. We were just enjoying every single moment, enjoyed every single moment, and made the most of it because you could get an injury the next game. You know, Adrian Heath, unfortunately, got a really bad injury and missed a lot of the games. So you had to enjoy it for the moment. Enjoy the moment. You know, it could easily be taken away from you. So we enjoyed ourselves, both on and off the field. We had a great team, a great camaraderie, a great spirit. And it was part and parcel of being a good team. You know, and I just think that, you know, will we get back to that? I don't think any team will get back to that in terms of the spirit we had. I honestly don't. I think football's changed unbelievably now, but, you know, let's wait and see.
Your third and final game and your most special moment at Goodison is the 3-1 against Bayern Munich. You seem to always have a knack, I think, as well, looking back through your record of scoring just after half-time. The man who gets us back into it. You did it in the 4-4 that you've referred to there as well, to get us equalised against Liverpool. And then we're 1-0 down at half-time against Bayern, and it's a famous quote from Howard that the Gladys Street will suck the ball into the net. In regards to the atmosphere, was, and it'll sound cliche these days because there's a lot made of atmospheres at grounds, and you know, I think it's a little bit of a faux pas on many people's parts to talk about how good atmospheres are at grounds.
Yeah.
Did it actually feel that way back then? Did it feel as if the crowd had a massive part to play in getting us back in that game?
Yeah. Listen, Dave, going up to the ground, we could sense it was a big game. In those days, you didn't go out for a warm-up. But Adrian Heath, who was injured, who I spoke about earlier, went out to have a look around, and he came back in and went, I've never seen anything like this at Goodison. This is incredible. We were like, what do you mean? We could hear everybody above the dressing rooms and the footfall going across the up the stairs and everything else. We thought, wow. But when we walked out that tunnel and hit the top step, the noise was incredible. They said 52,000. More than that. A lot more than that. So it was an incredible night. We go a goal down. Could have heard a pin drop. You know, this didn't happen to ever. You know, going a goal down against a big side, Bayern Munich, really top side, top players, getting at half-time. And you're spot on, Howard. Listen, keep doing what you're doing. You're not doing anything wrong. I can't fault you. Keep getting the ball in the box and they'll suck one in for the Gladys Street. That's what happened. Long throw from Gary and I got on the end of it. A flick header kind of thing. We're back in the game. Once we're back in the game, as I said to you before, we weren't losing that game. You know, there's only going to be one winners and you could see them physically wilt, you know, Bayern Munich. They're a big team, you know, playing in big atmospheres. But that night, they wilted. You know, we were just relentless, winning everything. Andy scores the second and Trevor wraps it up 3-1. But the whole night was... And I'd speak to my wife's family, who are all mad Celtic fans, have been to all the European nights at Celtic in the past from the 60s and the 70s. And they all came down in the droves for that night and they said they'd never witnessed a European night like that. You know, and Celtic are renowned for great nights at Parkhead, but they said they'd never witnessed anything like that, and it was a fantastic night, fantastic result on the end of it. We knew then, once we won that game, we'd won the European Cup Winners Cup final because we'd beat Celtic or Rapid Vienna, whoever got in the next semi-final. We knew we would beat them, but that was a final in itself, and the whole thing about it from start to finish was incredible.
Here's Kergel now with a chance for Bayern Munich. Edge of the penalty area. Great save by Neville Southall. Hoeneß still has an opportunity. Great chance for him to score, and he has done. And that is the away goal that Bayern Munich have been seeking. And Dieter Hoeneß has scored it. Bounced off Argenthaler. Out of play for an Everton throw. 20 yards from the corner flag on the right-hand side. Gary Stevens will take it. In towards Andy Gray. Up go the heads. Flicked on towards Sharp. Oh, he's there! Graham Sharp has cut it in. And Everton are level. Andy Gray's header under the near post, forced in by Graham Sharp, who has scored in every round of the competition and keeps up the record at the time that Everton needed it most. One more and it's Rotterdam. Stevens takes a throw in towards the near post. Pfaff held it, no he didn't. Gray locked it in, it's a goal. Andy Gray has put Everton in front. Bayern are furious because Pfaff came for the long throw, felt he was impeded, didn't collect it. But Andy Gray didn't stand around to find out. He thumped it in the back of the net. Celebration time at Goodison Park. They're very close to their first European final now because Andy Gray, a hat-trick in the quarter-final, has come up with a crucial semi-final goal. And Everton are in front and are on the way to Holland. Forced on towards Andy Gray, breaking inside the Bayern half. Trevor Stephen has a great chance. Edge of the penalty area. Trevor Stephen sends Everton to the final. 3-1 the score on the night. And that will be the goal that does it. Trevor Stephen's first ever
competition sends Everton to their first ever final, and you can tell your grandchildren about this night.
A lot of people talk about atmospheres these days. Goodison in its heyday like that, was it obviously it's a motivational factor because you're playing at home anyway, and it's obviously a little bit easier to play at home with the crowd on your side, given how volatile it can be, as we've seen maybe more modern day. Did it get you over the line in a lot of games? Is it something that you look back on and think, you know what, if we were playing away, we perhaps wouldn't have got back into this because we needed the crowd on our side?
Yeah, maybe, but I'd look at Everton now and I look at their Wii support, and that should get you over the line. Even the Wii support, 3,000, 5,000, 3,000, 4,000 fans going away from home, and the way they travel in numbers should get you going. Obviously it doesn't at times, but it should do. But certainly having the fans behind you, you know, at home will get you over the line. When they need you, and it's a big debatable point. Do the fans get behind the team and lift the team, or do the team lift the fans? In our day, it was both, and we knew when we needed a little bit of help, we'd get it. You know, and seeing them travel as well, Dave, in the thousands, you know, it was incredible for us. I mean, money was tight, but they still made it, and they still made that effort to go abroad and to the continent, everywhere else. It was fantastic. So we knew that we could rely on them, and I hope that they could say that they relied on us, you know, because together it was a fantastic experience to be a player at the time, and I'm sure a fan as well.
Its days are numbered, as we know. Bramley Moor looks, well, fingers crossed, touch wood, nothing's ever certain with us, but looks like we're going to be ending up there. Yeah. What will you miss about Goodison the most?
I think I've missed it for a long time, is the atmosphere, and I still think that, you know, and I know it's a very debatable point, you know, but it's different now. The atmosphere in stadiums are different since they've been all seater. I agree with that. You know, with some clubs, Celtic, as I mentioned, have had a safe standing area now at Celtic Park. You know, whether Bramley Moor accommodates that, I think they've talked about it. But I think we need to get the atmosphere back in the football stadiums. I don't know how we do it. You know, obviously a winning team will help, don't get me wrong. But I think I look at Germany, and when I see German stadiums packed and the atmosphere is incredible, and we need to get back to that a little bit. I think we've become a little bit blasé, but we've just sat back and thought, just let's wait and see. I think it'd be great to get back to the times, and you're playing in front of, you know, fantastic atmospheric stadiums. I think you go to Premier League games now and it's like sitting watching a film, you know. I think if we can get back to the days where we knew Goodison was a fortress, if we can go to Bramley Moor Dock and make that a fortress and make teams, and I talked to players who have signed for Everton, and they used to say, we hated coming to Goodison. And I'd say, why? He said, the crowd were very close to the pitch, right on our backs. You get every decision. It was a hostile place to play. That's what Goodison was all about, and the fans had a massive part to play in that.
Just one more thing before we finish this. When we leave, the day we leave, be a sad day, won't it, for all Evertonians and yourself as
well?
Yeah,
it will do, because, listen, we have to move on. You know, we're falling behind and we have to move on, and this is what we have to do. You know, but the good thing is that we ain't leaving L4. You know, we're still going to have a legacy there, which is important because it's been a massive part of the area, and it's something that we'll never ever forget. We've had fantastic times. Everybody will have their own memories. But we have to move forward, you know, and it's an exciting chapter for the football club at this moment in time, and fingers crossed it goes well, and we'll have a fantastic stadium on the banks of the Royal Blue Mersey.
What makes for a great vacation? Depends on who you ask. Are you looking to get away or bring everyone together? Do you want to get outside and play or see a play at the plate? Fortunately, however you operate, I'm the destination you've been looking for. The name's Missouri, but you can call me Mo. And I have just one question. What's your MO? To find your MO, tap now. Or for information on safe travel, come see me at visitmo.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.